Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the first Three Martini Lunch of 2017. Happy New Year, everyone. Along with Jim Garrity of National Review, I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. And while the year is new, today is our final installment of our special year-end awards for 2016. So we kick off the new year with our most prestigious awards from 2016. And the categories today are Person of the Year, Turncoat of the Year, and our New Year's resolutions for 2017. So, Jim, Happy New Year to you, and let's kick it off with the most prestigious award of the year, the Person of the Year.
Well, probably not a lot of suspense about this one. I'm going to echo Time Magazine. I don't really think you can make an argument that, Rob Portman is the Person of the Year, or something like Irving Schmidlap, or you know, something like that. In the end, Donald Trump was not just the most influential newsmaker of the year. This was his year. People did not think he would win the Republican primary, and he did it. People did not think he would win the presidency, and he did it. And he's going to be the central figure in American politics for at least the next 4 years. It certainly was the most surprising presidential victory in many years, probably right up there with Dewey and Truman. I think we talked in previous podcasts about how this represents a really significant cultural shift. We should not overstate it, obviously. It was about 100,000 votes in three states that ended up swinging the election. And obviously, as the Democrats are fond of reminding us, Hillary won the popular vote. I understand that, and $3 will get you a cup of coffee at Starbucks. but ultimately, look, this is a guy who, for all of his flaws, and there are many, and we've spent many podcasts laying them out, that Donald Trump sensed the mood of the people and put together an agenda that was not as consistently conservative as you and I might like, but was conservative in some ways, populist in others, and basically was what the American people wanted, or at least enough American people in enough states wanted this year, to do something that Republicans had not done since Bush's reelection in 2004. It's worth noting that was the only time in the past 25 years that Republicans have won the popular vote. So a most consequential figure. And it's really intriguing to think, Greg, the report that Trump became a lot more political after Obama made fun of him at the White House Correspondents' Dinner back in, I believe, 2011. So just think, Greg, if Obama hadn't made all those jokes, maybe Trump doesn't jump into the race and maybe everything turns out completely differently. So well done, President Obama. Well done.
Yes, let's place it at his feet. Absolutely. Well, I remember you and I were skeptical. Well, we were skeptical about his possible run in 2012, which did not happen. We were skeptical pretty close up to the point where he actually got in the race in 2015. Probably by the beginning of 2016, when he hadn't fallen in the polls, we realized he'd be a serious contender, but yeah. We figured somebody would emerge from the rest of the pack and match him up one-on-one. We talked about earlier in our year-end awards why that was not exactly good conventional wisdom. But give Trump credit for bucking the system, for tapping a nerve in a number
for listeners, bucking the system with a B, bucking the system.
That's right. That's right. I am going to give it to Trump as well, but he's going to share the award. And I think he's going to be okay sharing this award with Kellyanne Conway, because if you look at the team Trump started the year with, led by Corey Lewandowski, there were issues along the way that got him in trouble, not just the Michelle Fields grabbing incident, but Corey Lewandowski became part of the story, and I don't think Trump liked that. Then it was Paul Manafort, who was more mature, certainly, but had his own issues. Kellyanne Conway came in at a time when Trump was flailing. After the Democratic convention, he spent about a week or two in a Twitter spat with a Gold Star father, which is never a good way to spend your time. And he just seemed to have a tough time staying on message. He was basically reacting to every story here and there and not spending his time at his rallies actually articulating a message. And not only did Kellyanne Conway get him back on message, she made his message more conservative, which is not usually what you see from the Republican nominee. But Trump's not your usual Republican nominee, and he had some room to certainly get more conservative heading towards the election. And he talked about things, whether it was the economy, whether it was the culture, Trade, which is one that certainly divides some Republicans, but it worked really, really well in the Rust Belt. Fighting against political correctness, as you mentioned earlier in our award season, she got him to talk more and more about the things that she could figure out through her own polling and other sources that the people wanted to know about. You're always going to have people saying, oh, is this issue, or is this issue, or is this issue? Well, he hit on a lot of issues, and I think she figured out which ones were the right ones, and his own style, regardless of what you think about it, resonated, and that's why they won.
A fine choice there, Greg. And again, I think if you're right, beyond Trump, Kellyanne Conway really fits for that 1A category of winners. Now, I have a technical question about our next category, Greg.
Yes.
To be the biggest turncoat of the year, do you have to be a successful one? Because I have chosen to nominate Texas Senator Ted Cruz, and he really won it like four or five times over. And yet it always blew up in his face just about every time until the very end. And a bizarre kind of turn of events. So, because if you'll recall, early on when Trump jumped into the presidential race, thinking back to 2015, Ted Cruz was saying, it is the establishment's dream that Donald Trump and I get into a steel cage match. He tweeted out, you know, Ted Cruz was the one guy who said, I welcome Trump to the race. And, oh, I think this is terrific. And, oh, you know, basically Ted Cruz acted like he and Donald Trump were going to be the best of buddies in this Republican primary race. The common thinking was that the Ted Cruz folks believed that at some point Trump would burn out, or Trump would fizzle, or Trump would implode, and those Trump supporters would be looking for somebody, and they would gravitate towards Ted Cruz because Ted Cruz had not attacked Trump the way the other candidates had. Didn't quite work out that way. And in fact, if the steel cage match between Cruz and Trump was the one big was the dream of the establishment, well, they got their dream a couple months later when all of a sudden, you know, as the primaries heated up and it became clear that Trump was not about to implode, Cruz got tougher on Trump. There was that infamous debate where Cruz and Rubio and Trump really went at it with all kinds of sneering personal insults, kind of emulating the Trump style. It came down to it, and Ted Cruz said stuff like, I'm going to tell you what I really think. I think he is a pathological liar. Now, if you're a politician, I would urge you to always be careful about the phrase, let me tell you what I really think. Because that implies that everything you've said before isn't what you really think. And in fact, it's some either a spin or a lie or happy talk or something inaccurate with what your real, genuine internal thoughts and conclusions are. Much to Ted Cruz's surprise, he did not win Indiana, and they ended up being Trump ended up, you know, putting him to bed, so to speak, and won the nomination. And one by one, almost all the Republicans lined up behind Trump and endorsed him and said that if they're not endorsing him, they're voting for him, or they're pulling for the unnamed Republican nominee, or all kinds of other ways of saying that they were making amends with Trump and were getting up on the bandwagon. And then we came to the Republican convention in Cleveland. Ted Cruz was scheduled to speak, and everyone wondered, what was Ted Cruz going to say? And then the next question was, well, if he wasn't going to endorse Donald Trump, would he at least say nice things about him? Would he offer a quasi-modified limited hangout of an endorsement? And instead, to the shock of the delegates in the crowd and everybody else, Ted Cruz went out and said, vote your conscience. And the world went nuts. And at the time, I'd said that was one of the craziest, boldest, bravest, most principled, and potentially stupid moves I'd ever seen anybody make. You kind of wanted to pat him on the back and then shake him and say, what are you doing? Taking a genuine political risk, because there were plenty of people in Texas politics who were not happy with Ted Cruz at that moment and that remained angry. And apparently it kept building. And all of a sudden you started hearing talk about, oh, we're going to recruit Rick Perry to run against Ted Cruz in 2 years, and all kinds of other continuing murmurs of discontent in Texas Republican politics. George P. Bush had managed to come around to support Trump. And the attitude was, look, if Jeb Bush's son could come around, what other Republican does an excuse for not supporting Donald Trump? And then Ted Cruz jumped on board and he said, yes, I'm supporting Donald Trump to be president, after the defiantly refusing to do so at the Cleveland convention. And that was probably about 3 days before the infamous grab them by the you-know-what right. revelation, Greg. Right. So Ted Cruz jumped on board the bandwagon at perhaps the worst possible time. It blew up in his face one more time. And yet, you know, but it did pay off, I suppose, because Trump did win the presidency. But, you know, I want to say Ted Cruz for constantly flipping back and forth of whether he liked Trump or didn't like Trump, whether he was going to support Trump or whether he couldn't support Trump. The compass needle kept spinning around over and over again. And I think Ted Cruz, as much as I like him, has come out of 2016 a little diminished. I think there's still many things he can do in Washington. I think he'll be a great senator, but I think even his biggest fans were kind of left bewildered by some of the twists and turns of Cruz's journey in 2016. So that is my nominee for biggest turncoat of the year.
Jim, that is an outstanding choice. And as much as I respect Ted Cruz, and I still think he's a solid constitutional conservative, every bit of that narrative is correct. I think Ted Cruz's biggest problem is that he thinks he can outsmart everybody, and he overthinks things. And that happened time after time in this campaign. There was a revelation, I can't remember if it was before the election or maybe it was shortly after, where it came to light that the Cruz campaign actually told the Trump campaign after Iowa, but before New Hampshire, that they needed to tone down the insults or he wouldn't do as well in New Hampshire. And basically the revelation is that the Cruz camp was trying to keep Trump afloat so that he would knock out Rubio, who had obviously done better than expected in Iowa and finishing a close third. And so Trump apparently followed that a little bit in New Hampshire. He won there, and then the winning streak just mushroomed from there. Jim, that's not only odd, it's stupid. You had Trump losing in an upset in Iowa, put the boot on the throat and end it, and assume that you can maybe take down Marco Rubio, whoever else emerges as your later competition.
Yeah, in the future, if you have a chance to take down an opponent, take it. Don't wait for later. Don't wait for the perfect time. So.
Amazing. All right. Well, mine is different. It's also related to 2016, and it's also a group of people who were unsuccessful. It was one thing in this campaign to decide based whether it's policy, personality, whatever was your reason for not supporting Donald Trump. I think a lot of conservatives understood that. Many of them, of course, ultimately came around because they did not want to support Hillary Clinton. But sitting out or being never Trump based on conservative principle was understandable. What was not understandable was people who identified as Republicans and in some cases conservatives who decided that it was a really good idea to start supporting publicly Hillary Clinton for president. This list got fairly long. It was mostly full of people that the vast majority of Americans had never heard of, deputy former assistant secretaries of something or other. But some of these names on here were people who were just trying to hedge their bets, and it kind of blew up in their faces. Congressman Richard Hanna of New York, who was conveniently retiring, so he wouldn't face the voters over that. Meg Whitman, Hank Paulson, Brent Scowcroft, even guys who are fairly conservative on foreign policy like Max Boot and Bob Kagan. And, of course, at the bottom of the list, because he belongs at the bottom of every list, Richard Armitage. So, Jim, these are not necessarily people that you're shedding crocodile tears over losing as supporters, but they were opportunist. They basically got on board with Clinton after spending 8 years referring to her husband as absolutely horrific and in many cases accurately so. But now, because they wanted to present themselves as purest of the pure somehow on the Republican side, they believed that a Hillary victory would be the best thing for the GOP somehow. These people mortgaged their integrity, in my opinion, and it ultimately blew up in their faces. So not only are they my turncoats of the year, I'm really happy they're the turncoats of the year.
Yeah, and knowing some of those folks, most of them are not dumb, right? Most of them are not
right.
Stupid. Oh, you know, Hillary once said something like that. She must be conservative, you know. And then I would read the essays. I would read the columns and the articles trying to make the case. And not only was I not persuaded, the light from the star of persuaded took several years to reach me. I always kind of level, well, in this one speech back in 1999, Hillary Clinton said something that sounded, you know, like, no. Well, she supported, you know, intervention in Libya. Yeah, that turned out great. Plastic Man didn't stretch this way, right? I mean, this is always reaching all of these. Well, this, I mean, we make fun of people who, you know, make whole legal arguments on emanating penumbras from the Constitution. This was like citing protozoa surrounding Hillary. You know, if you'd cited her midichlorian level, I might have been more persuaded that she was on the light side. So, yeah, there was no case that Hillary Clinton was a conservative. There really wasn't much of an argument that she was going to steer policy in a more rightward direction. And I think it's a good selection there, Greg. Folks who probably need to kind of, you know, I'm not going to tell them to sit in the corner and don't vote anymore. I'm just going to tell him, sit in the corner and think about why did your disdain for Trump, which I get every last bit of that, why did that drive you to the direction where you started insisting not merely that he was bad, but that Hillary Clinton was good, which I think was a bridge too far.
Yes, think about what you've done. Except Armitage, you shouldn't vote anymore. Jim. Especially these foreign policy people. Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State was an unmitigated disaster in every conceivable way, and that was usually their excuse for saying that she should be Commander-in-Chief. Just amazing. All right. Finally, on to our New Year's resolutions for 2017. It's already January 2nd, so there's a good chance we might have broken them. Hopefully we won't. Jim, what do you have?
I'm going to continue to try to walk the tightrope. Look, I was among the people who was never Trump, anti-Trump, did not see him as an acceptable Republican nominee, did not believe that he was conservative in any meaningful sense of the word, appalled by his personal ethics, the way he treated people, finding his policy statements few and far between, lacking detail, lacking a genuine interest in how these things were going to work. I could spare you stuff. At this, I'm sure half people have like ended this podcast by now. And clearly, what he said resonated with a large chunk of Republican primary voters, and most Republicans were able to come around and say, okay, this guy is the guy we want. And I want to make sure I don't misread what the mood of voters is. I'm not convinced that I'm wrong. I still think there were better and more conservative choices out there. But on the other hand, it's possible that I judged him too harshly or threw the baby out with the bathwater when it comes to Donald Trump. The flip side, I also want to be able to tell the president when he's wrong. And not too long ago, we were talking about Republicans in Congress who are willing to go along with spending proposals if they were half funded. You and I thought that was a bad idea back in 2009 and 2010, Greg. I'm not going to change it just because we have a Republican in the White House. And so I'm going to be, doing my part to try to stick to what I think is right, whether or not it aligns with what the Republican president is doing. I'm certainly hoping that Mike Pence and Priebus and some of these good cabinet picks will keep him on the straight and narrow, but I'm not excessively optimistic about it. So my resolution in 2016, just call him as I see him, and hopefully people like that. And based on 2016, they probably won't, but no point in changing. Gone too far now.
Jim, it's probably not as exciting in these podcasts when we agree, but we effectively do in this one. I think our job, we intro every podcast every time. It's not always good, bad, and crazy, but it's always three martinis for conservatives. Our job is to assess things from a conservative perspective. And the times that a Republican administration acts in a conservative way, they deserve our praise. When they don't, they deserve our rebuke. And I think that is the way we will go forward. And I think we've done so in the transition time here. You mentioned the story we did several days ago about Republicans all of a sudden moving the goalposts on what's acceptable levels of unfunded spending. Absolutely, we're going to jump on that. At the same time, even though we weren't crazy about Trump during the election season, he has had some outstanding cabinet choices, and we have given him credit for that. And as these cabinet choices make decisions, as Trump does things, we're going to call them as we see them, not because we feel some obligation to be cheerleaders for the Republican Party, but because we expect them to embody and to advance conservative principles. When they do it, we'll say yay. When they don't, we'll let you know. So our job is to, once again, call it straight from a conservative perspective. We hope we've done that for the past 6+ years, and we have no intention of changing for the next 4.
All right, so at least we're on the same page for that. Good start to the year, and now we're all ready for things to go. It's all downhill from here, folks.
We'll see what comes next. Tomorrow we get a new Congress, and we'll watch everything unfold in what appears to be another a very eventful year. And we'll be glad to walk it with you along the way. Jim, Happy New Year. Talk to you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And be sure to tune in again on Tuesday for the next Three Martini Lunch.